"What exactly happened to Bartholomew?" he asked. "I don't know exactly," I said. "Jersey police say he got stabbed during a mugging outside his home."
"But you remain skeptical?" Helstein asked.
"My brother made a list of contacts," I said. "You're the only one of them still alive."
"Your brother was Mr. Joe Reacher?" he said.
I nodded. "He was murdered last Thursday," I said. "I'm trying to find out why." Helstein inclined his head and peered out of a grimy window.
"I'm sure you know why," he said. "He was an investigator. Clearly he was killed in the course of an investigation. What you need to know is what he was investigating."
"Can you tell me what that was?" I said.
The old professor shook his head. "Only in the most general terms," he said. "I can't help you with specifics."
"Didn't he discuss specifics with you?" I said.
"He used me as a sounding board," he said. "We were speculating together. I enjoyed it tremendously. Your brother Joe was a stimulating companion. He had a keen mind and a very attractive precision about the manner in which he expressed himself. It was a pleasure to work with him."
"But you didn't discuss specifics," I said again. Kelstein cupped his hands like a man holding an empty vessel.
"We discussed everything," he said. "But we came to no conclusions."
"Okay," I said. "Can we start at the beginning? The discussion was about counterfeit currency, right?"
Kelstein tilted his great head to one side, looked amused. "Obviously," he said. "What else would Mr. Joe Reacher and I find to discuss?"
"Why you?" I asked him bluntly. The old professor smiled a modest smile which faded into a frown. Then he came up with an ironic grin.
"Because I am the biggest counterfeiter in history," he said. I was going to say I was one of the two biggest in history, but after the events of last night at Princeton, sadly now I alone remain.
"You and Bartholomew?" I said. "You were counterfeiters?" The old guy smiled again.
"Not by choice," he said. "During the Second World War, young men like Walter and me ended up with strange occupations. He and I were considered more useful in an intelligence role than in combat. We were drafted into the SIS, which, as you know, was the very earliest incarnation of the CIA. Other people were responsible for attacking the enemy with guns and bombs. We were handed the job of attacking the enemy with economics. We derived a scheme for shattering the Nazi economy with an assault on the value of its paper currency. Our project manufactured hundreds of billions of counterfeit Reichsmarks. Spare bombers littered Germany with them. They came down out of the sky like confetti."
"Did it work?" I asked him.
"Yes or no," he said. "Certainly their economy was shattered. Their currency was worthless very quickly. But, of course, much of their production used slave labor. Slaves aren't interested one way or the other whether the content of somebody else's wage packet is worth anything. And, of course, alternative currencies were found. Chocolate, cigarettes, anything. Altogether, it was only a partial success. But it left Walter and me two of history's greatest forgers. That is, if you use sheer volume as a measure. I can't claim any great talent for the inky end of the process."
"So Joe was picking your brains?" I asked him.
"Walter and I became obsessed," Kelstein said. "We studied the history of money forging. It started the day after paper money was first introduced. It's never gone away. We became experts. We carried on the interest after the war. We developed a loose relationship with the government. Finally, some years ago, a Senate subcommittee commissioned a report from us. With all due modesty, I can claim that it became the Treasury's anti-counterfeiting Bible. Your brother was familiar with it, of course. That's why he was talking to Walter and me."
"But what was he talking to you about?" I said.
"Joe," was a new broom, Kelstein said. He was brought in to solve problems. He was a very talented man indeed. His job was to eradicate counterfeiting. Now, that's an impossible job. Walter and I told him that. But he nearly succeeded. He thought hard, and he applied strokes of appealing simplicity. He just about halted all illicit printing within the United States. I sat in his crowded office and listened to the old guy. Kelstein had known Joe better than I had. He had shared Joe's hopes and plans, celebrated his successes, sympathized over his setbacks. They had talked at length, animatedly, sparking off each other. The last time I had spoken to Joe face to face was very briefly after our mother's funeral. I hadn't asked him what he was doing. I'd just seen him as my older brother, just seen him as Joe. I hadn't seen the reality of his life as a senior agent with hundreds of people under him, trusted by the White House to solve big problems, capable of impressing a smart old bird like Kelstein. I sat there in the armchair and felt bad. I'd lost something I never knew I'd had. His systems were brilliant, Kelstein said. His analysis was acute. He targeted ink and paper. In the end, it all boils down to ink and paper, doesn't it? If anybody bought the sort of ink or paper that could be used to forge a banknote, Joe's people knew within hours. He swept people up within days. Inside the States, he reduced counterfeiting activity by 90%. And he tracked the remaining 10% so vigorously he got almost all of them before they'd even distributed the fakes. He impressed me greatly. So what was the problem? I asked him. Kelstein made a couple of precise little motions with his small white hands, like he was moving one scenario aside and introducing another. The problem lay abroad, he said, outside the United States. The situation there is very different. Did you know there are twice as many dollars outside the U.S. as inside? I nodded. I summarized what Molly had told me about foreign holdings, the trust and the faith, the fear of a sudden collapse in the desirability of the dollar. Kelstein was nodding away like I was his student, and he liked my thesis. Quite so, he said. It's more about politics than crime. In the end, a government's primary duty is to defend the value of its currency. We have $260 billion abroad. The dollar is the unofficial currency of dozens of nations. In the new Russia, for instance, there are more dollars than rubles. In effect, it's like Washington has raised a massive foreign loan. Raised any other way, that loan would cost us $26 billion a year in interest payments alone. But this way, it costs us nothing at all, except what we spend on printing pictures of dead politicians on little pieces of paper. That's what it's all about, Mr. Reacher. Printing currency for foreigners to buy is the best racket a government can get into. So Joe's job, in reality, was worth $26 billion a year to this country, and he pursued it with an energy appropriate to those high stakes. So where was the problem? I said. Geographically. Two main places, Kelstein said. First, the Middle East. Joe believed there was a plant in the Bekaa Valley that turned out fake hundreds, which were practically perfect. But there was very little he could do about it. Have you been there? I shook my head. I'd been stationed in Beirut for a while. I had known a few people who had gone out to the Bekaa Valley for one reason or another. Not too many of them had come back. Syrian-controlled Lebanon, Kelstein said. Joe called it the Badlands. They do everything there. Training camps for the world's terrorists, drug processing laboratories, you name it, they've got it. Including a pretty good replica of our own Bureau of Printing and Engraving. I thought about it, thought about my time there. Protected by who? I asked him. Kelstein smiled at me again, nodded. A perceptive question, he said. You instinctively grasp that an operation of that size is so visible, so complex, that it must be in some way sponsored. Joe believed it was protected by, or maybe even owned by, the Syrian government. Therefore, his involvement was marginal. His conclusion was that the only solution was diplomatic. Failing that, he was in favor of airstrikes against it. We may live to see such a solution one day. In the second place? I asked him. He pointed his finger at his grimy office window, aiming south down Amsterdam Avenue. South America, he said. The second source is Venezuela. Joe had located it. That is what he was working on. Absolutely outstanding counterfeit $100 bills are coming out of Venezuela. But strictly private enterprise, no suggestion of government involvement. I nodded. We got that far, I said. A guy called Kleiner, based down in Georgia where Joe was killed. Quite so, Kelstein said. The ingenious Mr. Kleiner. It's his operation. He's running the whole thing. We knew that for certain. How is he? He's panicking, I said. He's killing people. Kelstein nodded sadly. We thought Kleiner might panic, he said. He's protecting an outstanding operation. The very best we've ever seen. The best? I said. Kelstein nodded enthusiastically. Outstanding, he said again. How much do you know about counterfeiting? I shrugged at him. More than I did last week, I said. But not enough, I guess. Kelstein nodded and shifted his frail weight forward in his chair. His eyes lit up. He was about to start a lecture on his favorite subject. There are two sorts of counterfeiters, he said. The bad ones and the good ones. The good ones do it properly. Do you know the difference between intaglio and lithography? I shrugged and shook my head. Kelstein scooped up a magazine from a pile and handed it to me. It was a quarterly bulletin from a history society. Open it, he said. Any page will do. Now, run your fingers over the paper. It's smooth, isn't it? That's lithographic printing. That's how virtually everything is printed. Books, magazines, newspapers, everything. An inked roller passes over the blank paper. But intaglio is different. He suddenly clapped his hands together. I jumped. The sound was very loud in his quiet office. That's intaglio, he said. A metal plate is smashed into the paper with considerable force. It leaves a definite embossed feel to the product. The printed image looks three-dimensional. It feels three-dimensional. It's unmistakable. He eased himself up and took his wallet out of his hip pocket, pulled out a $10 bill, passed it over to me. Can you feel it? He asked. The metal plates are nickel, coated with chromium. Fine lines are engraved into the chromium, and the lines are filled with ink. The plate hits the paper, and the ink is printed onto its topmost surface. Understand? The ink is in the valleys of the plate, so it's transferred to the ridges on the paper. Intaglio printing is the only way to get that raised image, the only way to make the forgery feel right. It's how the real thing is done. What about the ink? I said. There are three colors, he said. Black and two greens. The back of the bill is printed first with the darker green. Then the paper is left to dry, and the next day the front is printed with the black ink. That dries, and the front is printed again with the lighter green. That's the other stuff you see there on the front, including the serial number. But the lighter green is printed by a different process called letter press. It's a stamping action, the same as intaglio, but the ink is stamped into the valleys on the paper, not onto the peaks. I nodded and looked at the $10 bill, front and back, ran my fingers over it carefully. I'd never really studied one before. So, four problems, Kelstein said. The press, the plates, the inks, and the paper. The press can be bought, new or used, anywhere in the world. There are hundreds of sources. Most countries print money and securities and bonds on them, so the presses are obtainable abroad. They can even be improvised. Joe found one intaglio operation in Thailand which was using a converted squid processing machine. Their hundreds were absolutely immaculate.
What about the plates? I asked him.
Plates are problem number two, he said. But it's a matter of talent. There are people in the world who can forge old master paintings, and there are people who can play a Mozart piano concerto after hearing it once. And certainly there are engravers who can reproduce banknotes. It's a perfectly logical proposition, isn't it? If a human being in Washington can engrave the original, certainly there's a human being somewhere else who can copy it. But they're rare. Really good copyists, rarer still. There are a few in Armenia. The Thai operation using the squid processor got a Malaysian to make the plates.
Okay, I said. So Kleiner has bought a press, and he's found an engraver. What about the inks?
The inks are problem number three, he said. You can't buy anything vaguely like them in the U.S. Joe saw to that. But abroad, they're available. As said, virtually every country in the world has its own banknote printing industry. And obviously, Joe couldn't enforce his systems in every country in the world, so the inks are easy enough to find. The greens are only a question of color. They mix them and experiment until they get them right. The black ink is magnetic. Did you know that?
I shook my head again, looked at the sawbuck closely. Kelstein smiled.
You can't see it, he said. A liquid ferrous chemical is mixed with the black ink. That's how electronic money counters work. They scan the engraving down the center of the portrait, and the machine reads the signal it gives off, like a tape head reads the sounds on a music cassette.
And they can get that ink? I said.
Anywhere in the world, he said. Everybody uses it. We lag behind other countries. We don't like to admit we worry about counterfeiting.
I remembered what Molly had said. Faith and trust. I nodded.
The currency must look stable, Kelstein said. That's why we're so reluctant to change it. It's got to look reliable, solid, unchanging. Turn that 10 over and take a look.